When Jordan's King Abdullah II ordered the execution of Sajida al-Rashawi in February 2015, he was closing a chapter that began nearly a decade earlier. Rashawi had been the failed suicide bomber in Jordan's worst terrorist attack, a 2005 hotel bombing orchestrated by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi that killed 60 people, mostly wedding guests. Her execution came after ISIS, the successor to Zarqawi's organization, demanded her release in exchange for a captured Jordanian pilot. The world was witnessing the culmination of a terrifying legacy that began in a remote desert prison and evolved into the most feared terrorist organization on Earth. Black Flags became an instant bestseller upon its 2016 release, winning the Pulitzer Prize for its gripping account of how ISIS emerged from the ashes of Al-Qaeda. The book resonated deeply in foreign policy circles, with President Obama reportedly keeping it on his nightstand and counterterrorism officials using it as required reading for understanding the psychological and strategic foundations of modern jihadism. In Jordan's notorious Al-Jafar prison, a young doctor named Bazel El-Saba encountered two men who would shape the future of global terrorism. One was Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, a scholarly intellectual whose radical writings declared Arab leaders to be infidels worthy of death. The other was Ahmad Fadil al-Halalay, known as al-Zarqawi, a high school dropout with a criminal past who controlled the other inmates with just his eyes. The contrast between the two leaders was stark. Maqdisi was mild-mannered and intellectual, offering nuanced interpretations of Islamic law despite his violent rhetoric. Zarqawi was his perfect enforcer, physically imposing, utterly ruthless, and completely devoted. Under Maqdisi's guidance, Zarqawi channeled his street thug rage into religious devotion, memorizing the Quran while developing intense hatred for Jordan's monarchy. Yet Zarqawi contained contradictions that hinted at his complex psychology. He ruled the Islamist prisoners with an iron hand, berating them for skipping prayers or watching television shows with unveiled women. He fearlessly defied prison authorities, once hanging a guard from a coat hook. But Saba also glimpsed another side. Zarqawi worshipped his mother, preparing meticulously for her visits and writing her gushing letters adorned with poems and hand-drawn flowers. He showed surprising tenderness toward vulnerable inmates, personally carrying a double amputee to the toilet and insisting on preserving his modesty during medical treatments. By 1998, a subtle power shift emerged among the imprisoned jihadists. The high school dropouts and petty criminals preferred Zarqawi's tough guy credentials over Maqdisi's nuanced theological arguments. Maqdisi gradually ceded leadership while maintaining spiritual oversight. When King Abdullah declared a general amnesty in March 1999, Zarqawi was among 2,500 prisoners released, a decision that would have catastrophic consequences. The day after his release, Zarqawi demonstrated his commitment by returning to Al-Jafar prison before dawn to minister to remaining inmates. Witnessing this dedication, the prison doctor remarked, "Here was a real leader. I knew at that moment that I would be hearing about him. This man was going to end up either famous or dead." 6 months after his release, Zarqawi was intercepted at Queen Alia International Airport by Jordanian intelligence agents. Captain Abu Haytham, a 15-year veteran of counterterrorism, had been tracking Zarqawi's preparations and was suspicious of his fabricated travel scheme to Pakistan. Though Zarqawi protested his innocence, the captain knew his prison stint had only hardened his views and expanded his network. Zarqawi's destination, Peshawar, was the gateway to Afghanistan where Osama bin Laden was based. "You can't just push him off on others," Abu Haytham warned colleagues. "Sooner or later, a problem like that always comes back." His first encounter with Zarqawi had been during a 1994 raid when 14 officers stormed an apartment where Zarqawi was hiding. They found him asleep, but he awoke violently, reaching for a gun behind his pillow. During interrogation, Zarqawi remained defiant, shouting religious curses at his captors. In Afghanistan, Zarqawi established his own training camp in Herat, independent from bin Laden's organization. Unlike bin Laden, who focused on attacking America, Zarqawi remained obsessed with overthrowing Jordan's monarchy and targeting Israel. The 9/11 attacks and subsequent American invasion of Afghanistan scattered both networks, but Zarqawi found refuge in Kurdish-controlled northern Iraq, where he joined Ansar al-Islam, a radical group operating beyond Saddam Hussein's control. Zarqawi's influence grew despite being far from al-Qaeda's leadership. He found new allies, including sympathetic Islamists in Baghdad who sheltered him during medical treatment. His hatred expanded beyond his traditional targets to include the United States, telling associates before leaving Iran that he wanted revenge on the Americans for the crimes they committed during the bombardment of Afghanistan. While bin Laden was fleeing in Pakistan, Zarqawi predicted to friends that the real showdown would happen in Iraq, a country with little recent history of religious militancy. Iraq, he told them, will be the forthcoming battle against the Americans. The world first learned about Abu Musab al-Zarqawi on February 5, 2003, during Colin Powell's speech to the UN Security Council justifying war against Iraq. Powell's claims about Zarqawi's connections to Saddam Hussein distorted intelligence assessments. While technically true that Zarqawi was in Iraq, he operated in Kurdish-controlled mountains beyond Saddam's reach. The speech contained selective facts favoring invasion, with some assertions baffling CIA analysts who knew the intelligence didn't support such claims. The speech ultimately tarnished Powell's reputation, but had another devastating effect. It transformed Zarqawi from an unknown jihadist into an international celebrity. Jordanian intelligence officials who had tracked Zarqawi were furious. As Islamist Hassan Abu Haniyeh noted, before anyone knew who he was, here was the Secretary of State of the world's most powerful government saying Zarqawi was important. The White House had inadvertently launched the career of one of history's most effective terrorists. After the invasion, CIA analyst Nada Bakos found herself interrogating former Iraqi officials while Baghdad's security deteriorated. Following the August 2003 bombings of the Jordanian embassy, UN headquarters, and Najaf's Imam Ali Mosque, intelligence increasingly pointed to Zarqawi as the mastermind. Despite pressure from supervisors concerned about contradicting the administration's war narrative, Bakos finalized her report confirming Zarqawi's involvement. "We knew there would be pushback," she recalled, "because what we were telling them meant that this was no longer a victory. It was a freaking nightmare." When CIA officials tried explaining insurgency characteristics to President Bush, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld interrupted, demanding they define insurgency. While Pentagon representatives remained unconvinced, preferring to believe the war was ending. Despite the brief respite from Saddam Hussein's December 2003 capture, Zarqawi's movement grew stronger daily, supported by thousands of embittered Iraqis and foreign Islamists. As Robert Richer, a senior CIA official, later put it, "The fertile soil was Iraq after de-Ba'athification. The ineptitude of the provisional authority and U.S. misunderstanding of Iraqis and their culture allowed Zarqawi to blossom and grow." On March 2, 2004, Zarqawi's operatives attacked Shiite pilgrims celebrating Ashura in Baghdad and Karbala with coordinated bombings and mortar fire. The attacks targeted the first Ashura celebration since Saddam's fall, killing nearly 180 people and injuring hundreds more. Many Iraqis blamed American occupiers for failing to provide security, with some even accusing the U.S. of orchestrating the attacks. In just a year since arriving in Iraq, Zarqawi had achieved his twin goals of harassing American forces and igniting sectarian conflict while cleverly shifting blame to the occupiers. After his mother's death, Zarqawi planned a devastating chemical attack on Jordan's intelligence headquarters. His operative, Jayusi, methodically assembled the operation with trucks, explosives, and 20 tons of chemicals. The plot involved a sophisticated attack sequence designed to create a toxic cloud that would prevent even ambulances from entering. Jordanian intelligence officer Abu Mutaz tracked the plotters through careful detective work, discovering their warehouse containing the yellow truck with its steel barrier buster frame and barrels of chemicals. When commandos finally cornered Jayusi in an apartment, he surrendered without resistance, despite having endangered his own family by keeping them with him amid explosives and detonators. In videotaped confessions, Jayusi detailed the plot that could have killed 80,000 people, explaining his absolute loyalty to Zarqawi. "I promised my loyalty to Abu Musaq al-Zarqawi. I agreed to work for him, no questions asked." In May 2004, Zarqawi orchestrated his most shocking spectacle yet. In a chilling video, Zarqawi, dressed entirely in black with a ski mask, towered over Nicholas Berg, a bound American in an orange jumpsuit. Flanked by four similarly dressed armed men, Zarqawi began reading a script with theatrical inflection before personally beheading Berg on camera. The 26-year-old Berg had traveled to Iraq against all advice, driven by dual ambitions, reviving his struggling communications equipment repair business and participating in what he saw as Iraq's noble transformation. Zarqawi had seized Berg simply because he wanted any American victim for his grotesque debut on the world stage. After Berg's brutal beheading video went viral, Zarqawi achieved his goal of eclipsing bin Laden in notoriety. The video strategically referenced Abu Ghraib prison abuses, with Zarqawi declaring, "The dignity of Muslim men and women in the prison of Abu Ghraib will be redeemed by blood and souls." 3 days later, Zarqawi announced a new terrorist organization, Al-Tawheed wal-Jihad, Unity and Jihad, positioning himself as bin Laden's rival. While CIA analysts wondered if he had overreached without institutional religious backing, Zarqawi's brutal theatrics drew countless admirers who began calling him the Sheikh of the Slaughterers. Iraq's historic January 30, 2005 elections became the battleground between democracy and Zarqawi's terror campaign. Bin Laden had denounced the polls as an apostasy against Allah, and Zarqawi worked tirelessly to ensure they failed by intimidating Iraq's Sunnis from participating. Robert Ford, the U.S. Embassy's chief political officer, faced the impossible task of convincing Sunni politicians to run for office despite the mortal danger. Sunni officials and candidates had been systematically targeted, shot, kidnapped, and blown up. Ford sought counsel from Tariq al-Hashimi, a former army colonel and leader of the Iraqi Islamic Party, who bluntly refused to field candidates. "We're not going to get ourselves killed." Hashimi articulated Sunni grievances, marginalization since Saddam's fall, attacks by vengeful Shiites, and nighttime American raids that violated cultural taboos. Despite Ford's warnings to Washington that proceeding with elections would produce a heavily lopsided Shiite Kurdish government, President Bush refused to postpone the vote. The election proceeded with millions casting ballots, but Sunnis largely boycotted. In Anbar province, participation was a mere 2%. Zarqawi had achieved his goal of Sunni disenfranchisement, deepening sectarian divisions. Hashimi eventually entered politics as Iraq's vice president, but paid a terrible price when Zarqawi's network killed his sister and two brothers in targeted attacks. Meanwhile, the hunt for Zarqawi intensified. Analysis of his captured laptop showed strategic, long-term thinking beyond immediate attacks. CIA psychologist assessments identified him as a classic narcissist who saw himself as an incarnation of ancient Islamic warriors, with his opinions now trumping centuries of Islamic scholarship. In July 2005, CIA analyst Nada Bakos discovered a revealing letter from al-Qaeda's deputy Ayman al-Zawahiri expressing concern that Zarqawi's brutality was damaging the al-Qaeda brand. "The Mujahid movement must avoid any action that the masses do not understand or approve," Zawahiri warned, particularly criticizing the hostage beheadings. Zarqawi defiantly responded by declaring all-out war on the Rafida, Shiites, and rejecting al-Qaeda's leadership advice. His brutal tactics, while repulsive to most Muslims, were attracting 100 to 150 jihadist recruits monthly. People think he's hurting Al-Qaeda's brand, Bakos observed. The truth is, he's helping his own brand because he's winning. General Stanley McChrystal's Task Force 626 had developed sophisticated intelligence on Zarqawi's operation, revealing his remarkably efficient system for recruiting, transporting, and deploying suicide bombers. To counter Zarqawi's advantage, McChrystal assembled an elite team of counterterrorism experts, placing them together in a situational awareness room surrounded by live drone feeds. His strategy was to apply relentless body blows against AQI to stunt its growth and maturation by keeping the terrorist network constantly on defense. By fall 2005, the impact was unmistakable. McChrystal's teams had eviscerated Zarqawi's command structure, removing hundreds of operatives. Of 21 known senior deputies, 20 were killed or captured. But then, on November 9, 2005, three hotels in Jordan's capital were struck by suicide bombers. McChrystal immediately recognized it as Zarqawi's work and potentially a fatal miscalculation. Following the Amman bombings, King Abdullah raced home and visited wounded survivors in hospitals. Seething with anger, he declared to his security chiefs, "We're going on the offensive. The gloves are off, and I want you to get him." This marked a dramatic shift in Jordan's security posture, with the monarchy deploying intelligence teams to work directly with American special forces against terrorist cells in Iraq. Stung by the public backlash, Zarqawi attempted damage control, claiming the wedding guests were merely collateral damage in an attack targeting Israeli and American intelligence. But even Al-Qaeda leadership rejected this excuse. Bin Laden's advisor sharply rebuked Zarqawi, ordering him to seek approval for major operations. In February 2006, Zarqawi orchestrated his most devastating attack yet, the bombing of the Al-Askari Mosque's Golden Dome in Samarra. Though no one died in the blast itself, it ignited unprecedented sectarian violence that killed over 1,300 people within days. White House officials considered it a tipping point in the war, with President Bush reportedly devastated by the news. The breakthrough in hunting Zarqawi came when interrogators leveraged Jordanian intelligence about a suspicious associate's travels. Under pressure, the man revealed that Zarqawi regularly met with a spiritual advisor named Sheikh Abdul Rahman. After 2 weeks of surveillance, Rahman's silver sedan suddenly broke pattern, swapping vehicles before heading northeast toward Bakuba. Following Rahman through multiple vehicle swaps, American forces tracked him to a secluded house in Hibhib, where they spotted a man in black who resembled Zarqawi. With Delta Force commandos delayed by helicopter troubles, McChrystal reluctantly ordered an F-16 airstrike. The fighter dropped two 500-pound bombs, obliterating the house. When Delta arrived, they found Zarqawi gravely wounded but briefly conscious, long enough to look into American eyes before dying at 7:04 p.m. from massive internal injuries. The Islamic State of Iraq had declined dramatically since Zarqawi's death. Though violence initially spiked in 2006-2007, the battlefield had fundamentally shifted. The Sons of Iraq, Sunni militias, began driving out foreign jihadists, while President Bush's troop surge flooded the country with fresh soldiers. Most devastatingly effective were the U.S. fusion cells, elite intelligence and special forces teams who hunted terrorists with unprecedented precision. The results were dramatic. U.S. casualties dropped from 904 in 2007 to just 314 in 2008, while Iraqi civilian deaths from suicide bombings fell by more than half. CIA Director Michael Hayden declared Al-Qaeda in Iraq to be in near strategic defeat. By December 2011, the last American troops departed Iraq, leaving security to the Iraqis themselves. The new leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, inherited an organization that lacked resources, fighters, sanctuary, and a unifying cause. But soon, within the chaos of revolutionary Syria, it would find all four. In Syria's sixth month of uprising, Baghdadi dispatched a small team to exploit the growing chaos. Though physically unimposing, his religious scholarship gave him stature among jihadists. He had been transformed at Camp Bucca, the Jihadi University detention facility, where he forged important connections, including with Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, who later became his chief deputy. After 10 months in detention, Baghdadi was released in December 2004 when a prison panel deemed the bespectacled academic posed little threat. He emerged with greater determination to fight America, resuming his doctoral studies in Islamic law while gradually being drawn back into the insurgency. When U.S. missiles killed the top two leaders in April 2010, Baghdadi, the scholarly figure once dismissed as insignificant, unexpectedly ascended to leadership. Despite lacking military experience, Baghdadi offered two crucial advantages: his willingness to provide religious justification for extreme brutality, and his suitability as a potential caliph due to his genealogical and scholarly credentials. He deliberately cultivated his image as divinely appointed, dispatching emissaries to Syria in 2011 to establish a launchpad for his caliphate and begin erasing the artificial boundaries between Islamic states. On January 24, 2012, Al-Qaeda officially entered Syria's civil war with the unveiling of the Al-Nusra Front. Abu Muhammad al-Jilani, dispatched from Iraq 5 months earlier, announced their arrival through a 16-minute video, claiming they would be the Muslim nation's weapon against Assad. Al-Nusra had already demonstrated their tactics with synchronized car bombings in Damascus that killed 44 people. While Syria's government and moderate rebels denounced these terrorist methods, al-Nusra's approach found support across the Sunni Muslim world. Young men from Saudi Arabia, Libya, and Tunisia traveled to join the fight, while wealthy Arab donors sent money and supplies. Some Gulf countries like Qatar and Kuwait allowed funding to flow to extremist groups, with officials privately viewing jihadists as the best hope against Assad. For Jordan's King Abdullah II, the threat was immediate. Islamist fighters attempted to infiltrate his country, planning attacks on targets in Amman before being captured by intelligence services. Abdullah worked desperately to contain the spreading conflict, building refugee camps and coordinating with Western powers on contingency plans. He warned fellow Arab leaders against supporting jihadists, telling one Gulf counterpart who admitted funding extremists, "You have moved yourself down on the menu, but eventually they're going to come after you." In May 2012, Robert Ford, the U.S. ambassador to Syria who had been recalled to Washington after security threats, met privately with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. During their meeting, Clinton expressed grave concerns about Syria becoming a regional disaster, with spillover violence affecting neighboring countries. Intelligence reports showed alarming growth in jihadist groups within Syria. By late summer 2012, key members of Obama's team urged arming moderate rebels as the least objectionable option. Clinton and Petraeus developed a plan to build, train, and arm moderate rebels, but President Obama remained unconvinced, ultimately rejecting the CIA plan. In April 2013, Baghdadi announced a major restructuring, merging his organization with al-Nusra Front under the name Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, ISIS. He claimed al-Nusra had always been only an expansion of the Islamic State of Iraq. The al-Nusra leader immediately rejected the merger and appealed to al-Qaeda's leader Ayman al-Zawahiri to intervene. Zawahiri publicly rebuked Baghdadi, ordering a halt to the merger. Baghdadi simply ignored the directive, claiming, "I prefer the command of Allah over the command that contravenes it." In Raqqa, ISIS quickly established a reign of terror through public executions and strict religious rules. They banned Western influences, required women to be fully covered, and enforced mandatory religious observances. Punishments ranged from public floggings to executions that seemed to occur almost randomly. Citizens faced constant financial extortion through fines and fees for everything, with the money funding foreign fighters' salaries. Most disturbing was ISIS's treatment of children. Schools were closed for months, then reopened with religious indoctrination replacing regular education. Orphan children were sent to military camps where they learned to handle weapons and drive suicide trucks. These youth camps were showcased on social media with images of prepubescent boys in military gear executing prisoners. Meanwhile, ISIS's ranks swelled to nearly 10,000 fighters, attracting recruits from 50 countries who were drawn by better pay and the promise of fighting for something bigger than Syria. Foreign fighters dominated Raqqa's streets as the group grew wealthy from extorted fees and oil sales from captured wells. To many Sunnis like Sheikh Zaidan, the revolt was purely an internal affair that Americans and Baghdad had misread. "This is a tribal revolution," declared Ali Hatim al-Sulaiman, the Dulaim tribe's leader. The Sunnis candidly acknowledged they had handed ISIS the keys to Anbar province, but only as a temporary measure. They believed ISIS was merely providing firepower to help assert independence from Iraq's central government. "They changed," Zaidan claimed. "Their leadership became Iraqi and their program changed completely. The government claims that Baghdadi is a terrorist, but he's not. He's defending 15 million Sunnis." Zaidan believed Baghdadi could be controlled. "He will not dare talk about Sharia here because he knows the tribes will not tolerate it." But ISIS was already settling scores. When Sheikh Abdal Razak al-Sulaiman was away, fighters destroyed his home with explosives. His offense? Leading the Anbar Awakening that had driven out Zarqawi's followers years earlier. ISIS's grand offensive began on June 5, 2014, with an attack on Baghdadi's hometown of Samarra. By noon on June 10, just 4 days after the offensive began, ISIS controlled Mosul's airport and central district. They emptied bank reserves, seized U.S.-made weapons, and took over the main prison, releasing Sunni inmates while executing about 670 Shiites, Kurds, and Christians. By late June, ISIS's total land holdings from western Syria to central Iraq was greater than the combined areas of Israel and Lebanon. Baghdadi now controlled oil wells, refineries, hospitals, universities, army bases, factories, and banks. His holdings in cash and financial instruments approached $500 million. On July 4, 2014, Baghdadi appeared at Mosul's Great Mosque of al-Nuri to declare the restoration of the caliphate. Every gesture was calculated for religious symbolism. He wore a black robe and turban like Muhammad on his final sermon, climbed the minbar steps slowly, and cleaned his teeth with a miswak stick in accordance with Islamic tradition. Facing his audience, Baghdadi formally declared victory, claiming the caliphate had been restored after centuries of absence. Though professing humility, he declared that Muslims worldwide must obey him as head of the Islamic State. The movement was spreading beyond Iraq and Syria, with self-proclaimed ISIS wilayats, provinces, appearing in Saudi Arabia, Libya, Algeria, Nigeria, Yemen, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. In each case, they promised freedom from tyranny but delivered armed dictatorship defined by corruption, cruelty, and death. The spark that truly ignited Arab passions against ISIS came in eastern Syria on January 3, 2015. Muath al-Kasasba, a 26-year-old Jordanian F-16 pilot, had been captured on December 24th when his aircraft suffered engine failure during a coalition bombing mission over Raqqa. Within 9 days, ISIS had planned his execution. They filmed al-Kasasba walking through a gauntlet of masked fighters before placing him in a metal cage. The most horrific part showed al-Kasasba, his orange tunic soaked in fuel, being burned alive inside the cage. Even as the execution was completed, ISIS continued negotiating with Jordan for weeks, pretending the pilot was still alive. Though ISIS had previously shocked the world with videotaped beheadings of Western hostages, it was al-Kasasba's immolation that sparked widespread condemnation among ordinary Arabs. From Jordan's cosmopolitan capital to conservative Saudi villages came howls of rage. While beheading was countenanced by the Quran and practiced by some governments, burning a human being, especially a practicing Sunni Muslim, broke an ancient taboo. Salman al-Oda, a venerated Saudi scholar, declared, "Only God punishes by fire," while Saudi Grand Mufti Abdulaziz al-Sheikh pronounced that ISIS members were enemies of Islam, not Muslims at all. Even Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, Zarqawi's former mentor, condemned ISIS after they deceived him during negotiations for al-Qasasba's release. "They lied to me and swore solemn oaths," he said, denouncing the movement he helped create for understanding conquests and victories only through slaughtering and killing. King Abdullah returned from Washington vowing war, launching massive airstrikes against ISIS positions before his plane even landed in Amman. Thousands of Jordanians lined streets to cheer the king's motor car. The normally secretive military allowed photographers to capture airmen writing messages on bombs, including, "Islam has nothing to do with ISIS." The defense ministry issued a defiant statement, "This is the beginning. You will know who the Jordanians are." As Zarqawi's former handler, Abu Haytham, had warned years earlier, "Look how fruitful they have been. They sometimes get sick, but they never die." The world now faced a terrorist organization unlike any other, one born from a prison in the Jordanian desert, forged in the crucible of Iraq's sectarian violence, and transformed into a pseudo-state that combined medieval brutality with modern media savvy. The black flags that Zarqawi once dreamed of raising over Jerusalem now flew across vast swaths of the Middle East, and the movement he created had evolved beyond even his apocalyptic vision.